This is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, we're talking with poet Kathleen Flanagan from Seattle. She began her career as a civil engineer and didn't discover poetry until her early 30s. Her collection, Plume, is a meditation on the Hanford nuclear site and her hometown of Richland, Washington. It won the Washington State Book Award and was a finalist for the William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America and the Pacific Northwest Book Awards. Her first book, Famous, won the Prairie Schooner Books Prize in Poetry and was named a notable book by the American Library Association. Her other honors include a Pushcart Prize and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and Artists Trust. She was the 2012 to 2014 Washington State Poet Laureate. Kathleen teaches poetry in the schools through arts agencies like Writers in the Schools and Jack Straw and Seattle University. For 13 years, Flanagan was an editor at Floating Bridge Press, a nonprofit press dedicated to publishing Washington State poets. She is currently president of Jack Straw, an audio arts studio and cultural center. Flanagan holds a Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing from Pacific Lutheran University, as well as a bachelor's and a master's degree in civil engineering. Her website, where you can visit her, click over to some of her poems, and learn more about her, is KathleenFlanagan.com. And I'm going to spell it for you, KathleenFlanagan. FLENNIKEN.com. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Sheila. Great to be with you.
And I am so excited to talk to you about all of your accomplishments and what it feels like to have done these things and participated so widely in the life of a poet. It is, of course, very interesting that you were educated as a civil engineer, and I'm curious to know how you discovered poetry.
I had my master's and bachelor's degrees in engineering, and I was working part-time as an engineer when my first son was born. But then when my second son was born, I decided to leave work for a while to be home. And while I was home, I started to realize that maybe engineering wasn't the best fit in the world for me. Even apart from that, I needed something to entertain myself, my brain, while I was doing the things around the house that I was doing. And I discovered an evening class in poetry, and I just thought that sounded like fun. I'd always enjoyed my friend's poems, and she'd given me books along the way when I was in high school and college. And so I started going to the library, checking out books, and then I started to take this night class. And I kind of fell in love with it right away. I think I was old enough to have a sense of what I liked and didn't like. I had been able to separate it from the school, that this idea that if you don't like what you read, that there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And it became instead reading for what I enjoyed. And if I didn't like a poem, it wasn't a mark against me. It was just not a good fit. So that kind of opened up the whole world of poetry to me, and then the writing class opened up this idea of experimentation, and it just one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was coming into my kids' schools and doing sort of a guest poetry lesson or substitute teaching for my writing teacher in his class, and it was just kind of a natural progression.
And a very successful one, Kathleen, because your first book was from a established, wonderful press, and your second book certainly has huge attention about your childhood near the Hanford Reservation. So the universe delivered just what you needed, didn't it, that class and that interest and that friend?
Yeah, the first book, it was 10 years of writing that went into that book. It wasn't just an instantaneous thing. It happened over time.
I'm glad to hear that.
And I had always been interested in writing. I mean, I even as an engineer, you don't necessarily associate engineers with writing, but that I felt was always my strength, was my ability to sort of convey information through my writing.
Conversely, did your training as an engineer influence something about the way you write poetry?
Well, I think it probably informs my likes and dislikes. When I think about what really moves me in poetry, what I really love is watching the mind at work, and I love the progression from you start at point A and you end up at point Z, and you don't know how you're going to get there. And I like the step-by-step-by-step movement of a mind in a poem, and I think that's probably associated with the thing that attracted me to engineering, you know, this idea of, okay, you need to do this, and then the next logical step is this. And I think that there's some relationship between those two likes.
I'm wondering, too, about your investigation of your childhood proximity to the Hanford Reservation and the nuclear power plants, wondering how your civil engineering training may have entered into your decision to use poetry as a way of looking at it?
I chose poetry because that was the form that I knew. I'd already written one book, and that felt like my best chance to say what I wanted to say. But I think the engineering background did influence some of the demands I made on the poems that I wrote. So I wanted those poems, even though I think when you're writing, I don't believe what you say has to be nonfiction. I don't believe that poetry has to all be true. There's Picasso's The Lies That Tell the Truth, and I really believe that. But in this particular project, it was a kind of documentary style writing that I was doing, and I wanted everything I wrote to be true. I wanted it to be factual, and that I could trace back directly to not just my engineering training, but to my sense of obligation to the people who worked out at Hanford and the work that they had done and my community where I grew up. All of that demanded of me that I be factual. So that was a kind of constraint I put on these poems that I wouldn't ordinarily put on a poem.
I see. Well, I know that you have some poems prepared to read to us today.
Yes.
Do you have one that might right now be from that collection?
What I'd like to do is start with one. It was the very first poem that I wrote. And when I wrote it, I didn't know I was going to end up with a book of these poems. It was just one. But this is a poem I wrote for my friend Carolyn. Carolyn lived just four houses up the street from me, and we were best friends all growing up. And her father was a blue-collar worker. He went out to the area, Hanford site, and he did work that he didn't talk about, just like my dad did, too. But my dad went off to work in a shirt and a tie and a jacket, and they did very different kinds of work. And Carolyn's father ended up dying of a radiation illness when he was in his 50s. So some of these poems are addressed to her. Some of them are addressed to her father. And this particular one is just kind of almost an apology for not noticing what was going on around us. It's called Bedroom Community. We were all bedded down in our nightcaps, curtains drawn as swamp coolers and sprinklers hissed every brown summer hour, or in winter, sagebrush hardened in the cold. It was still dark as our fathers rose, dressed, and boarded blue buses that pulled away, and men in milk trucks came collecting bottled urine from our doorsteps. Beyond the shelter belt of Russian olive trees, cargo trains shuffled past at 8 and 8, and the wide Columbia rolled by, silent with walleye and steelhead. We pulled up our covers while our overburdened fathers dragged home to fix a drink, and some of them grew sick. Carolyn, your father's marrow testified. Whistles from the train, the buses came, our fathers left. Oh, Carolyn, while the rest of us slept. The title, Bedroom Community, that came to me as a title because that was something we always said about our own town. That's how it was described. And as a very small kid, I remember thinking, what a strange way to describe your town, a bedroom community. I didn't really understand what it meant. But what they meant was Richland was a one company town. They were there in support of Hanford and really for no other reason. So,
but it goes so well with the idea of sleeping and metaphor
exactly.
Of being asleep to all this. Thank you. I wonder if we could move on to the question I have for you about what it was like to be a poet laureate. And I have a memory that some of your activities as poet laureate inspired poetry as well from you. Am I right about that?
Not as much as you would think. I feel a little bit like I should have gotten more tangible poetry out of the event. It was a huge part of my life, and I still enjoy thinking back on those 2 years. They were so important to me.
Can you describe what it's like?
And they helped me take myself seriously, but as a public person. And that was enormous for me, but I didn't really get that many poems out of it.
Okay, well, you're forgiven because I know that you're still writing poems, but what is the job of a poet laureate?
It's different in different states. So I think there's something like 43 or 44 states now in the country that have a state poet laureate. In our state, it's a program that's jointly overseen by Humanities Washington and Washington State Arts Commission, and it's a paid position. And the wonderful way that it's been set up is that you actually apply to be poet laureate, and you apply with a plan. And so anybody who applies gets to choose what it is he or she wants to do with the position. So in my case, I have a real interest in education, poetry in the schools, and especially for me, reaching third, fourth, and fifth graders. So that was one sort of angle of what I wanted to present. And then the other was, because I grew up in Eastern Washington, it was really important to me to get to all parts of the state. So I proposed that I would get to all 39 counties in Washington State. Now, the poet laureate before me, Sam Green, was wonderful, amazing. He started out the program, so he's the bar by which all others will be measured. And he got all over the state, too, but he didn't actually use that metric, the idea of every county. He was really looking at education districts and things like that. So for me, this idea of getting to every county was important, and it was also reminiscent of my mother and dad, who in the year of the Washington State Centennial, they did this weird thing that retired people do. They went off and visited every county in the state and took pictures of the county courthouse, which is kind of a bizarre and sort of random thing to do, but it's what people do when they're retired and they have extra time. And I was kind of tipping my hat to my parents a bit, too, and thinking of them so much as I made these trips, sometimes to parts of the state that I'd never been and others where I hadn't been in years and years and years. So that was really interesting.
What did you do while you made your visits?
Well, I had a poetry program in every county. Now, usually what I tried to do is have both a public program, like a reading in a library, something like that, and go into the schools. And I was, as I say, I was focused on third, fourth, and fifth, but sometimes it worked better for me to go into a high school or a middle school, and that was fine too. Of course, in many counties, I did multiple programs, but in some of the smaller ones, it usually ended up being just one evening program and then maybe one day in the schools, maybe all over the place. Once in a while, I think two different counties, what I heard was, well, there really isn't going to be an audience for an evening program. We can't justify it. So at least I had the schools. I could go into the schools and do that. And I think now that Elizabeth Austin has been poet laureate and now Todd Marshall has been poet laureate, there's an opening and understanding that, oh gosh, maybe we can put up a program for this and attract maybe a workshop or something among the citizens. So I think the program keeps building and getting bigger and better all the time, and that's very exciting to see.
I want to know what you think the health of poetry in our state is. Were the kids really receptive?
The kids are always receptive to various degrees. You're always going to be reaching a few people who make this discovery that, wow, this is something that really moves me, that I feel excitement and I feel a spark around this. You can see that happening. And really, my task is not to be a teacher to them that day. It's just to introduce them to the possibilities of poetry. Otherwise, they might not have seen it till a little bit later in their lives. And I think the earlier you can introduce poetry to a person, I think the more chance there is for it to take hold.
Absolutely.
And for them not just to become writers, but more importantly, to become readers of poetry.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with former Washington State Poet Laureate Kathleen Flanagan about her work and life in poetry.
Kathleen, has anyone used the title, The Possibilities of Poetry?
I don't know.
It's a wonderful phrase. You've had a lot of involvement in, let's call them, administrative parts of the life of a poet, such as poet laureate, such as editor for Poetry Press, And I'd like to skip over now to your, I think you're still currently president of Jack Straw in Seattle.
I am.
Can you tell us about that program and what you're doing for it?
Yes. So I'm currently board president at Jack Straw. I kind of help with the administrative details of that organization, and it's a great organization. So Jack Straw is a Seattle nonprofit. They are an audio arts studio and cultural center, and Jack Straw is focused on audio media, but they work in many, many different ways. They're a great collaborator. They have education programs, so we put together programs that go into the schools, and I've been a teaching artist for them. They have an artist support program. They have a great relationship with musicians in the city. Musicians come and record at Jack Straw. And also there's a Jack Straw Writers Program, which I would champion for even people who live in Port Townsend who might be willing to travel to Seattle on a few occasions during the year. And it creates this community among 12 writers. There's a curator who chooses 12 writers among the applicants. And then those writers go on to perform at various events over a period of a year. They get to know one another's work. They produce new work, and then they record that work. So they're given CDs that include their own podcasts, and it's just a great program. They get instruction on microphone use and presenting their work. It's just a lot of training and a lot of community building, and so it's really a great program.
And this program is open to any state resident or?
Yeah, well, it's open to anyone who can find a way to Seattle maybe 5 or 6 times in a calendar year.
I see.
For readings, for opportunities.
And do you go to the website to find a way to apply?
Yes, the applications are open always in the month of October. So, yes, you would go to the website. You can see who some of the previous 255 writers are that have been part of the program.
Wow.
It's become kind of a Rolodex of poets. And I keep saying poets, but what I really mean is writers, poets and nonfiction and fiction writers. It's really a great program.
I want to make sure the listeners know what the website is.
It's www.jackstraw.org. You can see who the writers are. You'll get to hear some of their work. It's a great, great organization.
And I'm glad that you clarified that it's not just poets. We have a lot of listeners who are avid writers as well as readers. So I'm sure that people will enjoy listening to the podcast as well as thinking about how they might apply and what they would be interested in doing. We like
it's
getting to see.
It's funny how I'll use the word poet, and I do this even when my daughter's a photographer, and I'll refer to her photos as poems.
So I like
this
that.
Habit
I think that's good.
Poetry is just kind of my generic for art or for writing or
back
whatever.
Back to the possibilities of poetry. So I want to be sure we get to hear some more of your poems. Are you ready to read a few?
Let me find something newer for you. I'm working on a manuscript of poems. I thought it was very close to done with it, and then the election happened, and now everything seems wrong. So I don't know why I moved to read this one, but I am this morning. This poem is called Coconut. In those days, we liked our ranks, our neat columns and rows of desks, or we didn't know not to, we little girls in plaid and sashes, we little boys with pocket slingshots. Turning to our reading in a classroom circumscribed by shoebox dioramas and the number line. We little boys running in recess packs. We little girls collecting hopscotch chains. Who fogged the small paned windows on orange afternoons to write our names. Then a birthday party after school. A pinwheel thumbtacked on a pencil to take home. And rarely, maybe once a year, boys and girls, someone brought a coconut to share, say a souvenir of David G's uncle's trip across an ocean, hairy husk hammered open, woody crescents divvied up, oily milk from a tiny Dixie cup. Though we didn't like the taste, and we complained as the world began impinging on our world with its satellites, its news reports, and something in us knew it shouldn't yet, because it was enough to lie in the dark and wait for sleep. We little girls decoding voices from another room. We little boys alert for squealing tires and police.
Kathleen, that's so beautiful, and I can definitely feel why you want to read it today. Just brings me back to childhood and that cusp of time when the larger world with its troubles is impinging.
There's a number of poems in this new collection which are poems of reminiscence. So there's that, and then there's also sort of this trying to make sense of the world now. Sometimes when I try to explain this project, I think there's a number of poems about marriage as well, and I think about it as a look at marriage, a long marriage, and the complications of that, and then this sort of troubled love affair I have with America, and not trying to find out what do these two difficult loves have in common. And I'm not sure I have gotten there yet, but it's certainly something that keeps calling me to keep writing.
Do you have another poem from that collection that you'd like to read?
Let me read one of the poems about marriage. This one's called Compare the Movement of Swallows, and it's based on a painting. In one of Magritte's paintings, he portrays this sort of a rain of men in business suits coming down in the sky. They're very uniformly spread across the sky, and that painting really inspired me. So this is, in a sense, it's a ekphrastic poem, but I think it works. I don't necessarily refer to it directly. Compare the movement of swallows with Magritte's matrix of businessmen, carefully spaced and hovering in the sky, who move not at all, but might, a characteristic of swallows, ready to swoop or suddenly plummet, though this is also nothing like Magritte's men, suspended in middle age, who may drop like leaky helium balloons or escape into the vanishing point, but will not acknowledge how desperate you are for something to happen. And by you, I mean me, framed in a doorway Magritte repeatedly painted empty. The swallows last evening dragged behind them my meanings with hooks that hurt even in recollection, a tug I can only describe as my life. Magritte's men are unfastened from the air, poised to rise or fall or disappear if they just decide. And by men, I've meant all along my husband in the yard where he fails to hear me calling or hears me and stands facing away, utterly still.
I don't know that every listener knows the meaning of ekphrastic, which is art in response to visual art, but you do such a wonderful job of drawing us both into your moment and the painting that I have no doubt this is a standalone, does not need the painting. However, I have a hunch if people wanted to see the painting, it might be online.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely online.
Tell us the name of it again.
I'd have to investigate that for you.
Okay. All right. But spell the painter's.
It has a name like, I can't remember. It has a kind of an offbeat name, which I have to look
up.
Well,
his name, the painter's name will help.
Oh, Magritte, Rene Magritte.
And you spell it?
Magritte.
Thank
you. He's a surrealist.
I would love to go on another hour listening to your poetry. And we have just a few minutes. Do you have one more you can read?
Yes, this is the one I was looking for. This is called Karaoke. And I know for some people this is great fun to go off and sing karaoke in a bar or something. But for another species of people, like including my husband, this is the worst possible thing you could ever be asked to do. So this is for my husband, Steve. Karaoke. Do something. You're his wife. Somebody begs me, when you're a couple of verses in, but wasn't everybody forced to take a turn? I watch you center stage where you never ever want to be, stunned in the revolving red lights of Jimi Hendrix. Are you experienced? A song we now know has no melody or end. Laughing is wrong. What else is there? Your boss records the crime on his iPhone. It's suddenly clear how much effort goes into just being, just holding ourselves still, our bizarre niceties and party store lays, the saucy meatball you stabbed, then abandoned on a plastic plate. A few with good manners pay no attention and pore over the list of has-been anthems. How did we get this far into a foreign century, this many levels down into middle age? Outside the bar, it's night. We've got to find our car in the frigging cold and make a conversation all the way home. I won't be able to say, I wanted to wrap you in a blanket like the survivor of a 5-alarm fire. And who cares if you were naked?
Thank you. I'm beginning to really feel your investigation of a long-term marriage. We're going to have to go soon, but I'd like to end by asking you this question. What are your hopes for the poets of the world and for their readers?
Well, I think for poets, I'm always hoping that a poet can find his or her own voice. When we first start writing, it's, I think, even a good thing to be imitating others, to sort of experiment through imitation and always be reading. But I think ultimately is when you finally find your way in and find your own voice. I think that's what I'm always hoping for myself, for each poem, and what I hope for other poets. And for the world of readers, I think it's finding the poets that really speak to you. And that isn't as easy as it sounds. I mean, it's not like just turning a dial on a radio where you can listen to this radio station and this song, and it doesn't suit you, so then you turn the dial and find somebody else that, oh, yeah, that sounds better. I think in poetry, you really have to do a lot of work, a lot of investigation to find the poets that really speak to you. But when you do, it's life-changing. You know, you find that poem that speaks in a voice you can hear, and it speaks about your life, and it gives you wisdom. So for readers, I hope they stick with it and just keep looking for that poet, those poets that will help them through their lives. And I really believe that's possible.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you so much for sharing your voice and your background and the beautiful, beautiful poems. It was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for asking me.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.